Let's call this meeting of the House Judiciary Committee to order. It is now 1:18 p.m. It is Monday, March 6, 2017. Before we begin, I would like to thank Christy Blair, the House Judiciary Secretary. She makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and I want to thank Alex from the Juno LIO, who makes sure we have sound, and he probably controls the camera in the ceiling as well. At this time, I want to remind committee members and those in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today, we have Representative Eastman, Representative Reinbold, my co-chair, Representative Fansler, and myself, Representative Clayman. We do have a quorum to conduct business. Our first order of business today is House Bill 120, Department of Law, Advocacy before the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, sponsored by the House Rules Committee by request of the governor. And I would note we have been joined by Representative Christ Tompkins. This is the first hearing on the bill in the Judiciary Committee, and here to present the bill is Ed Sniffen from the Department of Law. Would you please come to the table, identify yourself for the record, and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ed Sniffen. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law, and thank you for the opportunity to present this bill. HB 120 is a fairly simple bill. It allows the Department of Law to include some of the work that it currently does before the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission as part of the budget that it seeks to use regulatory cost charge funds for. And let me explain what that really means. So all regulated utilities in the state are subject to oversight by the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. And to pay for that regulatory oversight, there's a regulatory cost charge that appears on, you know, your utility bills. It's a small amount that goes into this fund, and that fund goes to pay for the costs of regulation for pipelines and regulated utilities. The Attorney General also has the function of protecting the public interest in these matters that come before the Regulatory Commission.
Just a brief interruption to recognize we've now been joined by Representative Kopp.
Certainly.
Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And so the Department of Law appears in matters that come before the Regulatory Commission to protect the public from, unnecessary rate hikes. If a utility company wants to raise their rates, they'll file a tariff with the commission, and we go in and protect the public's interest in making sure those rates are just and reasonable. So that function is paid for through this regulatory cost charge. What we're finding that we're doing more recently is we have a lot of matters that are coming before the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. As we work to try and limit our use of outside counsel, we're bringing more of that work in-house. And as part of doing that, we spend a lot of time on FERC matters now. And we would like to be able to charge some of that work toward the regulatory cost charge, and we think the statute recognizes through the pipeline regulatory cost charge that's something that's entirely appropriate.
One more brief interruption. Representative Ledoux has also joined us.
Yes.
You can continue. Thank you, Mr. Sniffen.
Thank you. A couple of things to note, too, about our request is the total amount of the regulatory cost charge is capped. So it's that cap is set by the legislature. So it's a certain amount of adjusted gross revenues from the utilities, and the piece that the Department of Law gets to use is 0.17% of that. And so we set a budget every year, you know, within that cap on how we think we're going to spend our money. So one of the nice things about this bill, it would allow us the flexibility to allocate our funds among pipeline and utility matters in a more efficient way, so we can utilize our budgets more efficiently. So we think it would definitely help. And those are funds that would normally be charged to the general fund that we can now charge through an appropriate use of the regulatory cost charge. So we've provided a handout, I think, that explains this probably a lot better than I've been able to do here. But we would be happy to answer any questions from the committee about this bill or what it does.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, I'm not very familiar with how the functions are of the AG's office are established in the statutes. And just a question that I come to the table with as a freshman is, why is it that, you know, we need to create a statutory provision to permit the AG to do something that, you know, the AG is deemed is in the public interest? Is that, can you just help me understand some of the background of why that's in statute?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, if I understand your question correctly, it's why do we have these public interest functions that the Attorney General pursues in statute versus is that just not an inherent power of the Attorney General? Is that sort of the question? Okay, I see you nodding. So I don't know if I can answer the statutory history of all of those things. I know that the Attorney General is charged with enforcing certain public interest functions of the state. For example, our consumer protection functions are things that the Attorney General does just to protect the public interest. This function through the Regulatory Affairs and Public Advocacy section is another one of those. Perhaps without those directions, it would be more difficult in this RAPID context, for example, to get funding for that function. I think just the way the Attorney General's authority is laid out, those are some of the things that she's been charged with doing, and why there aren't others in there, I can't speak to that.
Follow up on that issue?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, for example, if the Environmental Protection Agency is going through their process, do we need something in statute to give the Attorney General the opportunity to participate in a public advocacy role in that kind of arraignment?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, it would depend on the role of the Attorney General. So the Attorney General is charged with representing the agency that would enforce our environmental protection laws. So the Department of Environmental Conservation, for example, is a client of the Attorney General's, and the Attorney General will provide legal advice to that agency to the extent that the agency is pursuing, you know, whatever remedies or whatever cases they are pursuing.
Thank you.
Representative Kopp, I think I saw your hand earlier.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, I just want to say that I appreciate the Department of Law actually came by and briefed me on this bill earlier today, and it's pretty clear the predicament they're in with the advocacy role they have, but the way the law is structured now, it makes it very difficult for any cost recovery, and this resolves that, and it's a good piece of legislation.
Representative Reinborn.
Okay. Thanks. Again, this is my first time really being exposed to this bill within the last 30 minutes or so. But I guess I have a few different questions. First of all, would any of the fees that the people pay on their utility bills, are those the fees that go through the RCA, to the RCA with receipts, would those be used for the Attorney General to go before the FERC?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold. A qualified yes. It's a little complicated process. So we have a budget that we establish every year that goes before the RCA, and that budget is limited by the legislature. And then the RCA, you know, approves that budget. And depending on, you know, what sectors have received our attention through the year, for example, if we had a year that was heavily weighted toward gas regulation versus electric or wastewater, then a bigger portion of the regulatory cost charge would be assessed toward the gas utilities. And then if it was an electric heavy year, it would be the electric utilities might pay a little more of that. So it's a process that equalizes among the sectors fairly the work that we're doing. And then that gets passed on to the utilities, and then the utilities can pass that on to their ratepayers. They don't have to, but they generally do. And so the ratepayers are the ones who see that small line item bill at the bottom of their utility bill. It's 17 cents or whatever for the regulatory cost charge.
Can I have a couple more?
Follow up, Representative Ryan.
Okay, so basically we're asking the people to pay through their utility bills for the Attorney General to do work before the federal government, paying the Attorney General's expenses, from what I can tell. It's another way to increase the size of government, in my mind. But I want to know why now. Why is this coming? Does this have anything to do with the gas line, anything to do with the LNG project, any particular? Because, of course, you know, a lot of stories hit the news where the governor just went before and asked Trump for a whole bunch of help and loopholes for the state government to get out of doing things that the private sector has to do. So I want to know, does this have any impact on anything on the governor? It's a governor's bill. Why now?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, absolutely not. This will not affect, you know, the governor's, you know, gas line at all. This has come to our attention now because over the last couple of years we've been, you know, tasked with trying to find ways to save money, and one of those ways is to reduce our reliance on outside counsel. And so we have had FERC work done by outside counsel for 30 years, and we're starting to bring that work back in-house now. And we've saved significant amounts of money for the state by doing that. And since we've been doing that just recently, it's come to our attention that we're unable to pass some of those costs on to the shippers and the customers who are benefiting, you know, from our work. And this FERC piece is one piece that we saw where we were doing work that was benefiting Alaskans. It was in the public interest and could properly be included within the regulatory cost charge, the pipeline regulatory cost charge. So the people who would probably absorb most of this, if anything, would be the shippers of oil on the pipeline. It wouldn't be your normal utility customers. I suspect that your regulatory cost charge for your electric bill or your water bill will not be affected at all.
I think one of the areas about Representative Reinderwald, you were asking the question about charging the consumers. The legislature made the decision, I would say, many years ago that for a utility bill, part of the consumer protection function, you want the Attorney General's office involved in rate-paying cases, and so rather than just let the Attorney General's come off and say, well, this year we're charging X and next year we're charging Y, the legislature said, you can participate, but we're only going to let you charge 0.17% in terms of paying for the Attorney General to perform that consumer protection function. So we're not actually adding new collection authority by this bill. This bill is more about allowing the Attorney General's office to have more flexibility in just where they can or what they can do with the 0.17% that they're already collecting.
Through the chair, that's absolutely correct.
Okay. Representative, I didn't mean to interrupt your line of questioning, but you were asking some questions, and I thought.
I appreciate that. So this is explain to me why. I know you said something about outside counsel, and I understand what you're saying in regards to that, but does this have to do with anything with the current pipeline, the gas pipeline? Why now? I'm just trying to figure out. I know you said it's trying to save money. I know you spent money with Morris and Forrester or whatever, but this is just very intriguing timing to me, and I really want to know, who is this going to impact? Is this going to impact any private businesses in the state? Is this going to impact the budget in any way? Is this going to impact the rate payers? Who is this going to impact?
Certainly, through the chair, Representative Reinbold. So I heard about four questions in there. I'll try to answer them as I can. The first one is, why now? And I was explaining that in our effort to try and reduce our reliance on outside counsel, we brought some of this FERC work in-house, and that has just happened recently, and that's because of budget, considerations. And so it came to our attention just recently that we were unable to, use this fund to pay for some of this FERC work that is work that would otherwise be before the RCA, but for the need to do it at FERC first when it comes to the RCA. So that's the timing issue is why. It's just because we're now just starting to try to do more of this work in-house. Does have anything to do with the governor's new pipeline? No, it does not.
That question was two times ago. All the questions I just asked.
Okay, but I'd be happy to answer.
Yeah, you kind of repeated what you said 10 minutes ago.
Okay.
So that was regurgitation. What I specifically ask is, who is this going to impact now? Is this going to impact any business that is doing business in our state? Is this going to impact any ratepayer in our state? Those were the key questions. How is this bill going to impact Alaskans?
Certainly, through the chair, Representative Reinbold, the people who pay into the regulatory cost charge are all the regulated utilities and pipelines. The work on FERC would be a pipeline-related issue, so the people who would be impacted by this would be shippers on the pipeline, and they would have to pay the regulatory cost charge if there was an increase.
Thank you. Okay, so you're saying that the shippers... are you talking about the Alyeska oil pipeline? Is that the pipeline you're talking about?
Through the chair, yes, we're talking about TAPS.
Okay, you're talking about TAPS. That's what I've been trying to get to. That's what I was pretty certain of that. So explain to me who the shippers are. Who is this going to impact?
So through the chair, Representative Reinbold, the shippers on TAPS include, of course, all the major producers, shippers. We also have intrastate shippers on the pipeline. They include Tesoro. They include PetroStar. They pay intrastate tariffs to receive product off the pipeline as well.
Okay, so through the chair.
Representative Reinbold.
What kind of impact is this going to have? It sounds like the state attorney general is now going to go and do a bunch of work maybe before the federal government, the FERC Regulatory Commission. What kind of expenses are going to be incurred, and what are we going to be asking the private sector to pay in this recession?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, it's hard to say. It's not going to be an amount that is very noticeable. if it's you know, depending every year on how our budgets, you know, fall out, if we allocate a certain percentage of our time toward this FERC work and the shippers have to pay that, that cost will be passed on to these shippers, and they'll pass it on through their tariffs. Those tariffs are spread out over, you know, millions of barrels of product. And so their customers who buy that product, you know, would be the ones who ultimately pay that price. And I'm not... I don't know exactly how much that would be, but it would certainly be a pretty small amount.
Can I do my final? Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay, so basically, I would like to know. I think it's I did a bill, the Regulatory Impact Transparency Act. That was my first major bill here. This is impacting our private sector, and I would like to know every single shipper that this impacts, and how it's going to, and what kind of economic impacts, because they do investments over a long period of time. And I think we've changed taxes 7 in the last 11 years. There's been big proposals. This is another way to just get in another pocket of theirs. And I think it's important that we do the impact to the private sector before we pass different legislation. So I, you know, you might seem minuscule to you or to somebody else, but I think that it's fair that we do an impact statement on finances as well before we pass legislation such as this.
Representative Reinbold, are you asking that he provide the name of any shipper or basically any customer, not just for the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, but any customer of any type that could have any impact by this particular bill that allows the federal allows the department to participate in Federal Energy Regulatory Commission matters?
I would ask that, in particular, this bill, who it's going to be impacting directly, the different shippers and...
Well, and the reason I'm asking Representative Reinbold is that it seems like there's one, which is the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, which mm-hmm. you've got some intrastate and some interstate regulation. So the intrastate gets regulated, as I understand it, by RCA, which is Tesoro and others that refine here in the state and take the oil off the pipeline, and then everything that goes out is regulated by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And are you just asking about people involved in the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, or are you asking about any utility bill or anything else that might come before the federal the FERC, because I keep bumbling the
FERC.
Words. What are you asking for?
Anybody who would be impacted by this bill overall. I think it's a fair assessment that, you know, the people who will be impacted. I think it's good to know, and that's exactly what my Impact Transparency Act did. It showed the impacts to the municipalities, the impacts to the state agencies, the impact to the private sector, so that they could prepare. So this could affect people. I think it's a good thing to do is to look at the intended and unintended consequences of what this bill is going to do.
Certainly, and through the chair, Representative Reinbold, the regulatory cost charge for pipelines is assessed on all pipelines that operate in the state, and I can provide you a list of those pipeline operators if you'd like.
That's not exactly what I'm asking, Mr. Chairman.
Well, then that you can follow up, but that's the question I was asking, because there's some level at which one asks a question, what are the impacts of a regulatory, a 0.17% regulatory charge? It impacts everyone, it seems to me. It seems to me that regulatory charge, it's not just charged. If you charge it to Chugach Electric, which is a RCA, but Chugach Electric, they also have this 0.17% that's factored in, and so not only does the utility pay it, but they pass it on to their consumers, so there's a component which everyone's affected. And so I'm trying to get some clarity of actually who you're trying to get them to provide information for, because the universe could be everyone in Alaska or a very small number of people who own the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. And I'm frankly a little bit confused by the question myself, okay. And it seems like you're not happy with his answers.
Okay, well, can I clarify?
Sure.
Okay, absolutely. So basically you can do it in aggregate, but if a municipality is impacted by this, I'd like to know. If the consumers in aggregate are going to be impacted by this, I would like to know. If only the shippers of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline are going to be impacted, I would like to know. So when you're doing legislation, you usually try to look at the impacts down the line, and that's basically what I'm trying to do, not only in the short term, but in the long term. What are the long-term impacts? Because our economy, we're in a recession, And we have massive deficits right now, and we have to be very careful. Our economy is very delicate right now. We have to sometimes just a tiny change can have huge impacts. That's what I'm trying to assess. I'm trying to assess, is this going to have impacts on our consumers, on our shippers, on our economy?
And through the chair, if I may, Representative Reinbold, I understand your question. And the impacts are going to be only to the pipeline operators in the state. It's not going to be to the municipalities. It's not going to be probably to the utility rate RCC contributors. Our FERC work deals with tariffs on the TAPS pipeline. So the people who pay those tariffs are the people who are going to be impacted. And right now, the intrastate tariffs that are paid in the state are only by two companies, and that's by Tesoro and by PetroStar.
Representative Ledoux.
Well, when you say that only the tariff payers will be impacted by the FERC portion of this, doesn't all of the expenses kind of get split with everybody?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, the way the budget is set up is that we estimate how much of our time will be spent on pipeline matters and how much of our time will be spent on utility matters. And then within those different sectors, we break it down even further to how much is between different types of utilities. So the amount of money that the pipeline shippers would pay into the regulatory cost charge is what might be affected by our decision to do more FERC work versus other utility work.
Thank you.
Representative Kopp.
Yeah. So it's my understanding, the question, sir, it's my understanding now that the state only has year-to-year appropriations for FERC work to the Department of Law, and that those have to be appropriated each year. So we would have the authority to not make appropriations if we didn't wish to. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Kopp, I don't believe that's quite correct. So I think the legislature can make appropriations to the Department of Law, and we do use general fund money to, you know, do our FERC work currently. That is correct.
Okay. Then one follow-up, Mr. Chairman. I think in getting back to maybe what Representative Reinbold was getting at, is the regulated entities, anybody that comes before the RCA Department of Law, for the work that you're doing, those costs that are paid for by the regulated entities, what would we see the increase be for those regulated entities? And I think that's kind of getting what Representative Reinbold was at, is what can we expect as far as cost impact that are not being paid now, going forward as a result of this legislation? Do we have a projection?
Through the chair, Representative Kopp, excellent question. And I don't think that the total amount that we're going to spend in addition to what we already spend as a result of this bill is going to change that much. We're operating underneath this cap that's been set by the legislature already, and we're pretty close to that with our current budgets. We have some that we don't use that gets carried forward to the next year. Mm-hmm. If we're able to put some of our FERC work into that pot of money, it may fill that up a little more. It's difficult to predict, but it's in the maybe hundreds of thousands of dollars or less. It's certainly not into the several hundred thousand or even to the million range. It's not that level. We have set our budget where it is, and if we use that budget doing utility work, great. If we don't use it, it just goes into the next year cycle. If we're able to use some FERC work and put into that pot of money as well, we might use a little more of that. So it'll be less money that would roll over to the next year if we were to allocate it that way, depending on the work we do. If we have a FERC heavy year, for mm-hmm. example, we might use more of that money than we would otherwise. So I don't know if that answers your question, but it's not a huge amount of money.
Right, and just final, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Cobb?
Yeah, my understanding of the bill, as it was explained to me, it wasn't so much as a new revenue generation as it was having access to receipts that are currently collected in a way that is not available to Department of Law now when they're advocating for FERC matters.
Through the chair, that's correct, Representative Cobb.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Christ-Tompkins.
Thank you. And following that line of questioning from Representative Reinbold and Representative Cobb, I think maybe it helps sort of confirm my understanding of Representative Kopp's last question. What exactly is the relationship between the 0.7% statutory cap on RCC regulatory 0.7% cap on the regulatory cost charge, and what is the relationship with that between that 0.7 and the 0.17% that can go to the Department of Law? Where does the difference go? Where is that hanging out in the universe?
Certainly, through the chair, Representative Christ-Tompkins. So the 0.7% cap that I think you see in the statute, because there's two, you know, there's a 0.7% cap and there's a 0.17%. So the 0.7% is what's used by the Regulatory Commission of Alaska to fund their operations, and the 0.17% is what the Department of Law gets used to perform its public advocacy functions.
Thank you. Follow-up?
Representative Christ-Tompkins.
So if this piece of legislation passes and you're able to start using this to reimburse for FERC work that the Department of Law does, is that money coming to you because right now the Department of Law is not up to the 0.17% cap, and so there's sort of a delta between wherever you're at right now and 0.17%?
Through the chair, Representative Christ-Tompkins, that's exactly right. So that delta that you speak of is the only thing that would be affected by this bill. We might shrink that delta a little bit in some years, and we might not. We might, with the money that we currently spend, you know, be able to cover our costs by the way we allocate money among, you know, the utility functions and then our FERC functions. But, yes, that's the delta that could be affected. That delta in 2017, for example, was less than $40,000. As our budgets unfold, you know, who knows what it'll be in future years. So this is not really more about increasing that. You know, the cap is the cap. It's given us the flexibility to move money under the cap among the functions that we do. And it'd be, yes.
Follow-up?
Absolutely. Go ahead, Representative.
Thanks. I'm smiling a little bit because I feel like I'm getting, like, math problems, right, in, like, fourth grade math class or something. Okay, so we're not at a delta. So approximately where are we right now in terms of the, like, if we're not at 0.17%, you mentioned $40,000. Well, let's just, you know, speak apples to apples here. Where are we in terms of percentage terms? Are we at 0.15 as far as we being the Department of Law, right now?
Through the chair, Representative Christ-Tompkins, I don't have that exact number, but I would think we're probably closer to 0.165. I mean, we're pretty close, and that's what we budget for every year. And we don't necessarily use all that money that we budget for, but when we predict what our costs are going to be, it's pretty close. So adding this, I'm sorry, someone from our office just gave me the number. It's 0.167%. So I was pretty close.
And two more follow-ups, if I may.
Representative Christ-Tompkins.
All of them factual and numerical. So this bill will effectively allow the Department of Law to close that 0.003 gap, $40,000 or whatever it ends up being. So I guess my question is, because the Department of Law is not up to its cap right now, does that mean the RCA is participating in these extra 0.003% of overall utility funds? I mean, if the Department of Law is not as its cap, where does that delta end up going?
Through the chair and Representative Christ-Tompkins, it just gets rolled over. It's carried over to the next cycle, and it's considered in our next budget.
Yeah. And then my final question.
You can certainly follow up, Representative Christ-Tompkins, but if you decide there's another follow-up, we might not hold to that final question.
Okay. So this is really helpful, and I mean, from your background, I like the direction of where the Department of Law has been going in terms of becoming more self-sufficient, at least with this kind of legal work, and that makes a lot of sense, especially given the fairly unsubtle direction the legislature has been giving agencies over the last few years. Could you maybe speak to how much money the Department of Law has been spending on outside counsel for FERC work, and how that number has, or how your overall expenditures on FERC work have changed going from outside counsel to more of an in-house approach, and if this bill is passed, how you might see that trend continue to play out?
Certainly, through the chair, Representative Kreis-Tompkins. So over the last at least 2 years, we have reduced our reliance on outside FERC counsel significantly. I think our budget for FY18 is $375,000. It used to be over $1 million in prior years. And it depends on what's going on with the FERC cases. We might be in a big piece of litigation. We had this strategic reconfiguration thing that I think you might have heard about before that took a lot of effort, and we recovered $200 million in change for the state because of that effort, so and largely because of our outside counsel. So we still need them, but we are trying to bring more of that in-house, and the cost to the state for doing that is we have, you know, myself and another attorney in our section that deals with these issues, trying to learn this stuff so we can build the in-house expertise so we can rely less and less on outside counsel. But it's difficult when you have counsel that's been doing this for 30 years for the state. They have a lot of in-house knowledge and historical information from just doing it so long, and we rely on that historical knowledge as we go forward. But we're trying to use that counsel in more of an advisory role so we can actually do the work, and they can kind of help us navigate, you know, these kind of complicated, you know, FERC issues. And we're hoping that in the future that'll get even, you know, less and less.
So just a follow-up so that I understand. Under the current scenario, because we haven't given the Attorney General authority to participate in FERC matters, now if to participate in a FERC matter, you essentially have to hire outside counsel and then get a separate appropriation or put it in the budget somewhere to give funds on top of this 0.17% to actually participate in the FERC work.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, we use general fund money for our FERC work now, and having the ability to pass some of this cost on to the regulatory cost charge is probably not going to eliminate the need for that general fund money as well, but it is going to offset some of those costs, you know, a little bit.
And so what's essentially happening today is that 0.17% all, without the statutory change, that 0.17% all gets used in RCA matters.
That's correct.
And so if we pass this legislation, what it essentially means is from that 0.17%, if you, just picking a number out of the hat, if 0.07 was used for FERC and 0.10 was being used for RCA, what would effectively happen is the RCA, people regulated in the RCA would pay a little bit less, and the people regulated in FERC would pay a little bit more.
That's correct, yes.
Okay. But this 0.17 remains the same.
It does.
It's a question of where it's coming from and where you're spending.
Mr. Chairman, yes, that's correct.
Okay. Representative Reinbold.
Back to me. It's always the most fun the first time you have a bill hearing. Anyway, so the state has 40 to 50 years now of dealing with this pipeline. I mean, we have lots. We should have plenty of expertise in our state. Not sure why you guys always run to outside counsel. I think you guys spent $9 million last year on outside counsel, something like that, looking at the budget. But it just sure seems like with over 300 attorneys, you should have plenty of expertise and over 500 staff. But neither here nor there. Just want to ask a couple different questions. Is Tesoro and PetroStar the two main businesses, I guess, that will be impacted, and you don't see really any impacts to anybody else? Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, there may be some impacts on some Cook Inlet pipeline operators like Hillcorp, for example, to the extent that they're also purchasing oil from one of those folks for their operations or gas. I'm trying to think if they have any significant operations that would be impacted by that. But other than that, you're correct.
Okay, so the three main people or businesses is Hillcorp, Tesoro, and PetroStar. Are you anticipating anything else in the future? I don't understand what's going on with FERC and TAPS right now. I don't know. So is there something in the works right now? Are you anticipating some need for the Attorney General to get involved with FERC right now?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, currently we are in litigation involving tariff rates on TAPS for years 2011 through 2015. We're in a settlement posture on that right now. Depending on how that goes, if we end up in litigation on that case, that's going to require a lot of resources to litigate that case. But the end result of that case could mean, $500 million for the state, plus or minus. And so it's very important that we would have to deal with that litigation appropriately.
So basically, who's the lawsuit? It's between the state and who?
We have joint parties involved in this case. It's the state, the FERC trial staff, and then we have Tesoro and Anadarko, and we're challenging the rates that were filed by by the carriers for the TAPS tariffs from years 2011 through 2015.
Okay. And through the chair, the carriers being?
Exxon, ConocoPhillips, and BP.
Further follow-up?
So, sure. Are they going to be impacted by this at all?
Through the chair, no.
So, once again, through the chair, just Hillcorp, Tesoro, and PetroStar are impacted by this lawsuit?
Through the chair, yes. It would be the intrastate, the in-state folks who actually operate pipelines in the state.
Follow-up?
So you're asking for a law changed right now because you need something for a lawsuit that's going on from 2011 through 2015, some sort of tariff settlement. I don't know anything about this case.
Through the chair, no, this law probably wouldn't impact that much. I mean, to the extent that we can use some of these RCC funds to pay for a little bit of that work, but that work is going to far and exceed, any money we might get from, shifting money around in this regulatory cost charge.
Okay, so
go ahead, Representative Reinbold.
Just to get wrapped back around, so this law, basically, this change in statute, are you anticipating, you talked about that lawsuit that I didn't know anything about, 2011 to 2015. And then is there any other reason why now you guys want to do this where the Attorney General can work with the Federal Energy Regulation Commission? And is this in any way, is RCA supporting it and FERC supporting it? Is this something that they want to happen?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, we have approached the RCA, and they have not expressed any opposition to this, and I think they do support it. We have not approached FERC because they don't really have a role in this. To your other questions, I don't want to regurgitate myself, so I'd have to ask you to, was there another question in there that I missed?
Well, just anything you're anticipating, anything to go before the FERC, why this, I'm trying to get you to sell this bill, why it's important, because I'm not sold, okay?
Sure.
I'm just not. So I'm trying to get you to sell me why this bill is important. Do you anticipate anything else coming before FERC that requires the Attorney General, she's busy enough, to get involved?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, we will have ongoing matters with FERC on the TAPS pipeline until the pipeline is done. What those matters are vary by year to year. It's largely driven by what the carriers decide they want to do. If they want to try and raise their rates, they'll make a filing. We'll have to look at that and decide if those rates are just and reasonable. Those rates directly impact the production taxes and royalties that the producers pay to the state of Alaska, because those transportation costs are deducted when you determine value at the wellhead. So there's going to be a continual amount of work. And I want to just make one clarification that we would have a lawsuit now against these carriers, these TAP rates. These are administrative proceedings that happen before FERC. They file the rates, and we're taking a look at them to see if we agree the rates are right or not. I just didn't want you to leave with the impression that we have litigation out there against them. We have this administrative process going on that if it doesn't settle or go some way, that could turn into that, but currently that's not happening.
Okay. Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, now from answers to previous questions and what I see in the fiscal note for the department, it does sound like the .003 is probably not expected to get you the full amount that you're going to need to participate in these proceedings. Is that correct?
Through the chair, that's correct, Representative Eastman. Yes.
And what's the delta that we're talking about? How much money is involved? So if right now the cap is at 0.17, what's the value of that 0.17, and how much higher would it need to go to get you there? Because I recognize from previous hearings that the department is under financial constraints, and if this is an important issue and these I wouldn't want to see these types of proceedings competing unnecessarily against prosecuting cases in the criminal division, for example. Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, so the 0.17% is it's a percent of another number. It's the gross operating revenues of these pipelines and these utilities, and so it varies, you know, from year to year. I think last year it was roughly $2.1 million or something like that. And you know, of that pays for, you know, well, we don't use all of that, but you know, there's an amount under that pays for what we do at the Attorney General's office to represent the public interest in these proceedings. I don't know, and that's not going to change. We're not going to be able to use all of that just to do pipeline work, for example. I mean, it's we're going to use a small amount of that for our work related to pipelines, but that's mostly stuff that we do before the RCA on utility matters and not pipeline matters. How much money are we going to need down the road to continue looking at these TAPS, you know, tariff cases? I just don't have that answer. You know, our budget now, we have attorneys devoted to working on these matters. You know, I think maybe one or less to do FERC work. We're going to rely on our outside counsel as we have in the past, but hopefully to wean that off a little bit as we go forward. And then it's just going to depend on the kinds of cases that come up. So if they get complicated, if we get into a big piece of litigation for whatever reason and we have to start hiring experts, for example, and other things, it may cost a little more.
Follow-up?
Go ahead, Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So let's just talk about the most recent year. So if this last year it was $2.1 million, how much above the 0.17 would you have needed in order to not incur general fund obligations?
Whoa. Through the chair, Representative Eastman, that's a great question, and it's one I don't have an answer to. I'd have to.
Mr. Sniffen, if you want some time to get that information, we certainly are not here to answer questions. You
yes.
don't have the information at hand. And
we'll see if we can get that for you, Mr.
Thank you very much. No further questions.
I don't see any further questions. So what I'm going to do now is open the public testimony for House Bill 120. Is there anyone in the room or online who wishes to testify about House Bill 120? I see the masses have heard all about details of FERC policy in the state. I see no one on the screen. I see no one in the room, so I'm going to close public testimony at this time. Any further questions from the committee? Representative Ledoux.
Yes, this is for Mr. Sniffen. So what procedure have you used to ensure that you've gotten the word out about this bill to any of the stakeholders who could be impacted by the bill?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, we have spoken with representatives of the utilities. We approached the Department of Commerce and approached the Regulatory Commission of Alaska to get their input, you know, on the bill, and they have provided us some feedback, and they didn't have any concerns with it. I have heard from representatives of Hillcorp that I know they're aware of the bill, but they didn't express any other opposition to it at that time. And we haven't heard from any of the other potential stakeholders.
So have you called those stakeholders, or have you emailed them about this? What exactly have you done to make sure that they're at least aware of this?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, no, we haven't done either of those things other than through informal communications. Robin Brenna, as you may be familiar with, represents Tesoro, and I know he is aware of the bill and hasn't expressed any concern about it to me. We couldn't think of any others who would have an interest in this, who aren't, you know, very aware of the bill and its impact, so we didn't feel the need to go any further.
Thank you.
Thank you. I don't see any other questions.
Right here.
Oh, I'm sorry. I couldn't tell. I missed the signal. Sometimes you have to get your hand up higher. Well, but you seemed quite content without any. Go ahead, Representative Reinbold.
Thank you, and I'm just going to follow up with Representative Ledoux. I absolutely think it's important to get these people before us. Anytime a bill impacts the other side, it's good to hear the other side. So I think it's very important to get the operators, the producers, anybody who this is going to be impacting, in all fairness. I think not only should you do your due diligence to outreach to them, because they're busy. I mean, they're busy producing, you know, trying to keep oil in the pipeline and some of the operators operating that. I just think it's fair to give them a call, and I think they should have their opportunity to let us know if they support this bill one way or another. So it's a little disappointing they haven't reached out to them. Thank you.
Okay. I don't see any other comments. So what we're going to do is we're going to hold House Bill 120 at this time for further review. I know you'll be able to get back to us with that cost question that Representative Eastman has asked. And thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, can we get a brief at ease before we go on to the next bill?
Sure.
Thank you.
Or brief at ease. Our final order of business today is House Bill 20, Solemnized Marriage, Elected Officials. And today we will continue through the amendments from Friday's meeting. At this time, I'm again going to pass the gavel over to my vice chair, Representative Fansler, for the duration of our hearing on House Bill 20.
Thank you, Representative Klayman. As a recap, on Friday, we took up amendments to House Bill 20. We heard two of them. Amendment number one was adopted, and amendment number two failed. We're going to now move on. We have now up to 13 more amendments, or 13 total, excuse me, to go over, and I will hear a motion, but I do want to say that when we are speaking to these amendments, I would like us to keep strictly to the amendment itself, so as not to speak to the entirety of the bill, but rather the amendment and what it does, and we will limit folks to that if we need to. So, is there a motion to move amendment number three?
Yes, Mr. Vice Chairman, I move amendment number three.
Object.
And we have an objection. Representative Eastman, can you explain what amendment number three does?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. Amendment number three, written in response to the committee substitute that came to us out of House State Affairs. The committee substitute added a provision of not requiring elected officials to hold and solemnize marriage. And what this amendment does is this says that that's a very valid thing. We wouldn't want elected officials to have to solemnize marriage if that, you know, wasn't what they were interested in doing. And it would apply this to the section rather than simply to elected officials only. I believe that everyone should be in a situation where if they're not, you know, feeling good about participating in solemnizing a particular marriage or don't have time or for any other reason, that they should not have to do so.
Thank you, Representative Eastman. Any discussion on the matter? Representative Klayman.
I would just note that I believe this topic is adequately addressed in the amendment that was adopted, and I maintain my objection.
Any further discussion or wrap-up? All right.
I'll just add a comment, but I wanted to give somebody else a chance to first before
then. Let's take Representative Reinbold, and we'll have yours under wrap-up, Representative Eastman, if that's okay. Representative Reinbold.
I just want to make sure that I fully understand this, that this is basically exempting anybody or any organization that doesn't want to solemnize a marriage doesn't have to. Is that correct?
Representative Eastman.
Yes. Representative Reinbold, through the chair, or through the vice chair. And there are some differences that I would point out in response to Representative Klayman's comment. Yes, the amendment does cover portions of this, but let's go back to the amendment that was passed on Friday. And that amendment is substantially different from this amendment in a couple of ways. And one of the ways is because the amendment that Representative Kopp put forward specifically mentions a person and how a person doesn't have a duty. The language here is different in the following ways. One, it refers to either an individual or an organization, because this statute applies to congregations and religious organizations as well as individuals. So under a strict reading of Representative Kopp's amendment, only persons and individuals would be captured in that. And I think it's the desire of the committee to make sure that religious organizations are also captured, since religious organizations are performing marriages in this state currently. And the second part of that is that his amendment spoke specifically to having a duty, and this the words here are requires or obligates, which I think is a bit more broad. Certainly duty is one thing, but there are other expectations, obligations that may come into mind, and so this establishes, I think, with greater clarity that we are not expecting or intending for anyone on this list of those who can solemnize marriage to be under an obligation to do so.
Just a brief follow-up.
Representative Klayman.
I would just note, actually, in paying a little bit more attention, that this actually would, the amendment to Amendment 1 that involved subsection 2, meaning court officials, this amendment would now make this apply to court officials, and that's another reason I don't support it.
Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As far as the language on subsection 3 of the bill itself, I'm looking, so at line 12 of the bill, version D that we have, where it says before or in any religious organization or congregation, I would like to hear, you know, from legal if they believe the word person, as in the amendment we adopted, covers that. I know in the law, and we have three attorneys here, I think the law sees corporations as persons in more of a collective sense, and congregations are certainly made up of persons. So, I mean, in my plain view reading, if we say nothing in this section creates or implies a duty on a person authorized to solemnize under three referring religious organizations or congregations, those are all made up of persons. I think that amendment covers that. But if there's question, maybe we could get legal on the phone to see if they
Representative Kopp, is that a request to have legal?
I would, because Representative Eason raised the question, and I'd like to know if in fact, because that was part of my intent in the amendment, is to have those organizations covered.
I would concur.
Okay. So we're going to have dial out to Ledge Legal. Maybe we'll continue with our discussion while we wait for that, and if we need to wait for a long time, I may say let's hold this one and move to Amendment 4 just to have a proper use of our time. Representative Ledoux and then Representative Reinbold.
I was going to just say that certainly under elections law, persons means corporations or a wide variety of things. I'm not sure that persons means that with respect to other laws. So, yes, it would be worthwhile to hear from Ledger Legal.
And Representative Reinbold.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So basically what I would like to do, if we do have time on our hands, is go back to Amendment Number 1, since you said we were referring, you guys keep referring back to it, because it basically says delete all material that I love, at page 2, lines 1 through 4, and then it inserts by an individual holding a public office in the state, which I want that to be anybody in the state, that And then in Section 2, it basically excludes judges. And then it says anybody who has authorization to solemnize marriage. But it doesn't make sense to me to only make it someone under Section number 4, line number 3, page 2, it says by an individual holding an elected office. I don't know why he added that in there.
Thank you, Representative Reinbold. Representative Klayman.
Representative Kopp, I think in one of the discussions I've had with you about the statute itself, which is involving subsection 3 about essentially marriage ceremonies before any religious organization or congregation according to that established ritual or form, I think the way you had explained that to me is that there are certain congregations that don't have, for lack of a better description, an ordained minister, but they're kind of these group lay-led congregations, and I think that subsection 3 was designed not that the entire church would solemnize the marriage, but that somebody, through the way they manage their religious ceremonies, that somebody takes on that responsibility on behalf of that organization, although that may be somewhat changing from week to week or month to month, depending on the details of how they perform their ceremonies. And I always understood, and subparagraph 3 in the statute was designed to accommodate still an individual person and not the organization. So it wouldn't be a business. It would still be a person. It's just that because they're not formally ordained by the Methodist Church, for lack of a better example.
Yes, and through the chair, I was just responding back to the spirit of Grunberg here. Yes, that is my understanding. And also with subsection 3, it does accommodate religious beliefs and practice that are non-Westernized, you know, indigenous to our people here. And that language particularly makes it very clear that however you, bring two people together in this union, if it is according to your established ritual or form that you commonly practice, I think it goes back to the spirit of independence in Alaska, where we recognize that we want those people to be free. And I certainly hope this applies to persons, but hopefully we can get them on the phone and get an opinion.
Representative Reinbold.
Thank you. Since this is judiciary, we are doing what I've witnessed in this committee the last 4 years, definitely getting deep into the purpose and making sure that what we pass is exactly what we want it to pass. But bottom line is, I want to ask, I don't care if it's you or the person who's carrying the bill, why did we adopt the committee substitute with this great new language in it and then turn around in amendment number 1 and take it out? It makes no sense to me. I feel like we're wasting time. And so I'd like, I guess it would be the sponsor of the bill to explain why.
Representative Klayman.
Representative Reinbold, we have an amendment process. There was a committee substitute introduced. There was an amendment offered. We voted on the amendment. It was adopted. That's the standard process, Representative Reinbold. You were here and you participated. I don't understand I guess I don't understand your question.
It's very simple. We also agreed to adopt the committee substitutes, and the committee substitute brought forth some really, really good language. So I don't know why we wasted our time adopting the committee substitute if we were going to turn around and take the language out in the First Amendment. It's repetitive. And
Representative Reinbold, I don't mean to quibble words with you, but we actually didn't. We adopted the committee substitute for purposes of discussion, and so that's, we actually have not, and then we take that up for purposes of amendment, and that's where we're moving forward. We're using that as the basis to consider various amendments, which is exactly what we're doing right now.
Representative Reinbold.
And now we're going to go back through the amendment process, because it just didn't make sense to bring a brand new committee substitute with some incredible language in it, and then to turn around and go out and then want it back in. I mean, I guess that's why we shouldn't be running off and having discussions, because maybe we would understand why this happened. But I think this language is phenomenal, 1 through 4 with the committee substitute. So that's what my amendment's going to do, is it's going to bring back that language again.
We will look forward to seeing Amendment 14.
<We will. laughs>
So we still don't have Ledge Legal on the line. With Representative Eastman, of course, the process in mind is I'm tempted to say hold this amendment number 3 until we can have Ledge Legal come on and answer our questions, so we won't take action on it right now until we get that opportunity. Whatever we're doing, we will roll back to Amendment 3 when we get Ledge Legal on the line. But I am going to officially hold this for now, and do you have any other amendments you'd like to move?
So. In fact, I do. Thank you very much for asking.
Do we need to make an emotion or anything, or is that just...
I think I can just hold it on my own as the chair. Yeah.
I don't know. So I'm just asking.
That's my understanding of the process.
It's my understanding also. Mr. Chairman, I would like to move amendment number 4 for purposes of discussion.
Thank you, Representative Eastman.
I'll object so we can have discussion.
We have an objection by Representative Klayman. Representative Eastman, can you explain to us what amendment number 4 does?
Yes, Mr. Vice Chairman. I had agreed to carry this amendment previously at a colleague's request, and I understand that this was a more comprehensive way of dealing with some of these issues, so I am putting it before the committee for their consideration.
Any discussion regarding amendment number 4?
And
Representative Klayman.
I believe this particular amendment is inconsistent with the limited purpose of the bill, and so I do not support amendment 4.
Okay. It seems like we have Ms. Bruce from Ledge Legal. So I'm now going to hold our discussion on amendment number 4. I'm going to roll us back up to amendment number 3 and pick that back up at this time. And Ms. Bruce, are you with us?
For the record, this is Linda Bruce with Legislative Legal.
Thank you, Ms. Bruce. I'm going to have Representative Kopp ask his question at this time.
Thank you, Ms. Bruce. The question has come up with respect to the amendment number 1 adopted by the committee to the committee substitute language we're working off. And specifically, the question is, amendment number 1 on where subsection C begins on line 5, the language says, nothing in this section creates or implies a duty on a person. And that's the key word we're looking at, a person authorized to solemnize a marriage under A1, which is religious leaders, 3, congregations, groups of people organized for a religious purpose, and then 4, of course, the elected officials. So the question is, does the word person cover A3 with respect to those religious congregations as defined there, religious organizations or congregations, does the word person cover the language of 3 for purposes of this law?
Through the chair, Representative Kopp, yes, it does. Our definition for person that applies to the statutes is found under AS01100608, and it does include an organization. The Supreme Court has interpreted this provision expansively, so it's my opinion that it would include those organizations.
Thank you.
Representative Eastman, follow up with Ms. Bruce.
Yes, Ms. Bruce, through the chair. And in your legal opinion, would a house church or a home church that's not necessarily a legal entity with no 501c3 status or anything like that, would that also be covered under this amendment with the word person?
Through the chair, this is Linda Bruce with Legislative Legal. Representative Eastman, it's my opinion that yes, it would, if it's a commonly understood meaning.
Thank you.
Representative Ledoux.
So are home churches with no legal status, they can solemnize marriages under our current statute?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, courts would, you know, interpret this broadly. I don't know about the legal status of those churches, though.
So just follow up?
Follow up, yep. Through the chair.
So could anybody call themselves a home church and solemnize a marriage under our statutes as they exist right now?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, our current statutes state any religious organization or congregation, which is a pretty broad term, so as long as they have an established ritual or form commonly practiced in the organization or congregation, then I believe so.
Follow up?
No, I don't think so. Thank you.
Any more questions for Ms. Bruce? Representative Reinbold.
Ms. Bruce, basically what I'm trying to figure out is would this amendment protect all Alaskans that have the authority to solemnize a marriage from any, that they can refuse for any reason?
Ms. Reinbold, are you, Representative Reinbold, are you referring to Amendment Number 3 or Amendment Number 1?
3.
3, okay.
I guess we better tell Ms. Bruce which one that is.
Yeah, Ms. Bruce, just so you're wondering, I don't know if you have them labeled this way or not. Amendment number 3 is 30-LS0242/D.1.
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, this amendment is similar to the amendment J.1. The only difference that I see is that this amendment pertains to all persons authorized to solemnize marriage, whereas the previous amendment applied to persons under A1, A3, and A4.
She didn't answer my question.
Follow-up, Representative Reinbold.
So I did not hear an answer. I hear it was similar. That's not the question I ask. I ask, does this allow anybody who has the authority to solemnize a marriage the right to refuse for any reason?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, yes, it does. The statute already is permissive. But this subsection does do what you're stating.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further discussion. Representative Eastman.
Just because it hasn't been specifically put out, I just wanted to make mention of the fact that there are two categories of people in the portion that we're dealing about, that we're referring to as two. I'm not sure if that's a subsection, but I think it might be. So in subsection 2, marriage commissioners are involved there. And I think we might inadvertently be leaving them out of this if we don't include them. My amendment, of course, would include everyone.
Is there any further discussion? I think we're...
Mr. Chair, I would just one comment. Marriage commissioners, by virtue of the fact that the marriage commissioner is a voluntary process, nobody can be made to be a marriage commissioner. If you go down and apply for the license to be a marriage commissioner, you know exactly who it is you're marrying, and that's something you want to do. So it, by virtue, there's no course of nature to being a marriage commissioner. You don't get the license if you don't want to do it. So, yeah.
Representative Eastman for wrap-up.
Well, I was going to say, now that may be the practice as you're familiar with it. Our statute simply gives the judicial officer in each judicial district the ability to appoint marriage commissioners. It doesn't say whether that's going to be voluntary or whether that's going to be any particular member of the judiciary or whether that's going to be you or I. So I don't know that that's necessarily logically necessary that be the case in all parts of Alaska.
Do a call to question. Everybody get the vote on this one. So.
Amendment number three still, right?
We're still on amendment number three.
No objection to the question being called.
Okay. There's no objection to the question being called?
No, it's just we were on four and then we jumped back to three. But
we're back on three.
I'm fine with this. Sorry. You can call a question. I'm good with it.
Everyone, no objection to the call to question? Then may I get a roll call vote? This is on amendment number three, whether we adopt it or do not adopt it.
Representative
Bansler.
Nay. Representative Eastman.
Yay.
Yay. Representative Reinbold.
Yes.
Yay. Representative Cox.
Nay.
Nay. Representative Price-Tompkins. Representative Ledoux.
Nay.
Nay. Chair Klayman.
Nay.
Nay. That's two and four.
So this amendment fails by a count of two yays and four nays. We will now take back up amendment number four. We had a motion and we were just had heard from Representative Klayman on his objection to amendment number four. Is there further discussion regarding amendment number four? Seeing no further discussion, Representative Eastman, I'll give you a wrap-up if you'd like.
Yes, seeing as there's no discussion and these issues seem to be addressed in other amendments, which we may have already considered or will consider, I would withdraw this amendment.
Okay. Amendment number four has been withdrawn. Representative Eastman, do you have any other amendments?
Yes, Mr. Vice Chair, thank you for asking. I would move the adoption of amendment number five.
Object.
All right. We have the movement of amendment number five and an objection. Representative Eastman, can you please explain what amendment number five does?
Yes, Mr. Vice Chair. It's actually very simple. Currently, we take the opportunity in statute to recognize many different individuals, organizations, titles. We have listed ministers, priests, and rabbis. We have not mentioned in any of these lists an imam of a mosque. We do have mosques here in Alaska, and I think it's important that they would be equally recognized in the statute and that they also would not ever be in a situation of having an expectation or obligation to perform a marriage that they weren't very enthusiastically behind.
Representative Ledoux.
You know, it kind of, my problem with it here is that it doesn't parallel the language of Section 1. So if you had in Section 1, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, I'm really not trying to go down rabbit holes here, but if you list
it. We'll think of it as a ferret hole and not a rabbit hole.
But It would seem to me that the more appropriate place, if anybody thinks that that's necessary, would to be put minister, priest, rabbi, imam in one, and then you wouldn't need to list them in two because they'd just be covered by the way two works anyway. And to have it in two, when you don't have it in Section 1, it's kind of confusing to me.
Representative Kopp, then Representative Eastman.
So, Mr. Chairman, my plain view reading of number 3 marriages may be solemnized before or in any religious organization or congregation according to the established ritual or form commonly practiced in the organization or congregation. That clearly would cover imams and mosques.
Representative Eastman, then Representative Ledoux.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. Now, in the amendment that we just voted down, all persons and organizations would have been covered equally without needing to list or refer to anyone specifically. I think that was the beauty of that particular approach. But since we now, you know, are sticking with listing pastors, rabbis, priests, and so forth, then I think there is an argument to be made that imams should be mentioned as well.
Representative Ledoux.
You know, I don't really have any heartburn about mentioning imams, but I mean, you could probably go through, and I don't know what Buddhists call their practitioners or Hindus call their practitioners, or there are probably, you know, a myriad of religions, and not to be disrespectful to any of those religions, I mean, I think it's covered by, you know, minister, priest, or rabbi, the three major religions, and then kind of the caveat, major religions here, and then the caveat that it includes just about anything else that is considered as a religion. Because if we start going through this and we say imam, then we really have to mention, you know, the Buddhist. We really have to mention the Hindu. We have to mention, I mean, you'd want to get, you know, a world religion encyclopedia to make sure that we're not missing anybody.
Representative Klayman, then Representative Reinbold.
I would just note that subsection C has the not requiring or obligating one particular individual doesn't really make sense to do it in subsection C. And I agree with what Representative Cobbett has observed, that subsection 3 of paragraph section A adequately includes not only the Islam, but also includes Buddhism and any number of religions that I'm not going to even try to begin to list. I was reminded at somewhere that somebody observed that if you go to the Department of Defense, they actually have classifications of different religions that they recognize, and there's a group of, quote, other religions. And it's, when you look at the list, there's actually quite a lot in there, and I wouldn't even begin to want to name them all, but I think that they would all be covered under subsection 3 of this statute, which is why I think we're getting overly specific in Amendment 5.
Representative Reinbold.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's why I'm exactly agreeing with my colleague directly across from me, that if we would have passed the previous amendment, it would have covered all. I think that's the whole purpose of this amendment, is to show, because that one failed, now we have to go through each individual, which might take weeks. But the whole purpose, we should have had an inclusive for any individual. We can't just protect the rights of us as elected officials. We need to protect everybody's rights. I think it's very pompous to say we as elected officials are protected and nobody else is. I think that we need to have everybody, and I think that's why we just had Leslie Golan that said everyone would have been protected and had the right to refuse, but now we have the obligation to go through each and every single type of religion or whatever, because we refuse to protect everyone. We're trying to pick and choose. Thank you.
If I may just take my indulgence to speak on this matter, I very much appreciate where Representative Eastman is coming from on this, to be as inclusive as possible, and I appreciate that. My worry tends to lend towards Representative Ledoux's worries, I believe, that when we do these kinds of things, it creates a legislative intent. And the intent suddenly becomes, we chose to purposefully include one group, but perhaps we should, you know, have included something else, and why did we not? So I would be much more preferential to leaving it open to the widest possible group, as I think that Representative Kopp has pointed out in his description of it. I do worry when we start trying to put in lists and lists and lists, simply forgetting one person or one group, all of a sudden opens up a very big can of worms. So I will speak against this, but I very much appreciate where Representative Eastman is coming from for this amendment. Final discussion, wrap-up, Representative Eastman.
Yes, Mr. Vice Chair, and to wrap up, I think you make a perfect point. I completely agree with it, and the fact is we are setting legislative intent in the decisions we're making right now, and it's going to be very difficult, I think, for courts looking back on this to see other than we are setting up specific types of individuals and categories and organizations to affect marriages in this state, and we are specifically mentioning that some of those have to perform marriages only because we've told in statute in the passage of this bill that there are other people who don't have to. So now we're setting the situation up where, you know, if I'm a marriage commissioner before this bill happens and I, you know, say, hey, I'll marry you, and then, you know, you show up on the wedding day and, you know, for whatever reason, I don't want to. What about me? We've now, you know, created this expectation that, well, of course, if I said once that I'd be marriage commissioner, that, well, I must still want to do it, which that's a presumption. There could be any number of reasons that I show up and it's not the right day, it's not the right time, it's not the right place. So I think...
Point of order, Mr. Chair. This amendment has nothing to do with marriage commissioners. This amendment has to do with imams and mosques, and I think he's not on topic.
Representative Eastman, I'm going to say if you can wrap this back up into the imams and mosques, that
certainly,
would be
certainly.
Much
thank
appreciated.
You. Yeah, I appreciate your mentioning that. The imams and mosques are important to discuss and to include. Because we've started down this road of saying that there's, you know, specific people who can marry and specific people who can't, which I think is kind of an irony because, you know, we've already said elsewhere in statute that we kind of want everybody to be able to do marriages, and we've created, you know, ways for that to be accomplished. What I would like to see us do, and as soon as I can convince the majority of this committee to do it, I think, you know, would love to, I'd like to take a step away from the state, you know, having to come up with a list.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to again object. He's way off topic of this amendment.
Oh, that's all I had to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Eastman. And we will now take a roll call vote for Amendment Number 5.
Amendment D.11, Amendment 5. Representative Eastman?
Yes.
Yay. Representative Reinbold?
Yes.
Yay. Representative Cox?
No.
Yay. Representative Price-Hopkins? Sorry.
We hope he'll be back.
Representative Ledoux?
No.
Nay. Representative Fansler?
No.
Nay. Chair Klayman?
Nay.
We have 2 yays and 4 nays.
So, by a vote of 2 yeas and 4 nays, Amendment Number 5 fails. Representative Eastman, would you like to make a motion regarding Amendment Number 6?
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. I move the adoption of Amendment Number 6.
Object.
We have an objection. Representative Eastman, can you explain what Amendment Number 6 does?
I certainly can. Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. And you'll find this very similar to the previous discussion. And I have proposed an amendment here before you that would specifically list ministers, priests, and rabbis as deserving of protection under this statute.
Any other discussion? Representative Ledoux.
I think Amendment Number 1, which we adopted last Friday, does the trick with respect to ministers, priests, rabbis.
Representative Klayman, are you maintaining the objection, and do you wish to speak to it? Or
I need to speak. I agree with what Representative Ledoux said.
Okay.
I maintain my objection.
Okay. Any further discussion on Amendment Number 6? Seeing no further discussion, Representative Eastman, would you like to have a wrap-up on it?
Certainly. I hope that Representative Ledoux is correct, that it is captured. If it's not, then I intend to vote for this amendment.
Okay. May I get a roll call vote for Amendment Number 6?
Which is 8.6. Representative Hensler?
No.
Nay. Representative Eastman?
Yay.
Yay. Representative Reinbold?
Yes.
Yay. Representative Kopp?
Nay.
Nay. Representative Ledoux?
No.
Nay. Chair Klayman?
No.
Nay. Two yays, four nays.
All right. So by a vote of two yays and four nays, Amendment Number 6 is not adopted. Representative Eastman, would you like to make a motion for Amendment Number 7?
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. I move the adoption of Amendment Number 7.
Object.
We have an objection. Representative Eastman, can you please explain what Amendment Number 7 does?
Yes, Mr. Vice Chair. This specifically lists commissioned officers of the Salvation Army as deserving of protection under this statute.
Representative Ledoux.
Same comment I had with respect to Amendment Number 6. Amendment Number 1 does it.
Representative Reinbold.
Thank you. And I think why this is just so important, and we actually probably should do 100 more amendments, because we refused to sign off on the amendment that gave all Alaskans the right to refuse. I think we have an obligation to go through all people that this might impact. So this committee, on a vote of 4-2, decided to only protect select individuals, and I absolutely think that this is a critical amendment, and that we need to do everything we can to protect as many Alaskans from their right to refuse as possible.
Any further discussion? Representative Ledoux.
You know, I understand Representative Reinbold's philosophical concern with protection of all Alaskans as opposed to select Alaskans, but Amendment Number 1 takes care of these select Alaskans, which are the subject of Amendment Number 7. I mean, there's just no doubt that the people that are referred to by Amendment Number 7 are taken care of by Amendment Number 1.
Representative Reinbold.
I'm not convinced of that at all, and so therefore I choose to strongly disagree with that statement. I'm not convinced of that, or we would have been consistent in voting to protect all Alaskans.
Representative Eastman, wrap up.
Well, I was just going to, you know, put a question to my colleague who just made the last statement, or saying, is it your intent in voting this way to make sure that everyone is covered?
Well, Representative Reinbold.
You know, I'm hoping that she's right in her statement, Representative Ledoux, who spoke earlier, but I'm absolutely not convinced of that. And that's why I do believe we need to protect all Alaskans. But one, I know this will protect one more class. You know, if we're going to cherry pick and say just elected officials or just that, whatever, I just think we need all Alaskans have the right to refuse based on religion or right of conscience. This takes us one step closer, and so I will be a yes vote on this amendment.
Thank you. That was my wrap-up.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Eastman. We will now have a roll call vote for Amendment Number 7.
Which is 8.7.
Yes.
Representative Ledoux.
No.
Nay. Representative Bansler.
Nay.
Nay. Representative Eastman.
Yay.
Yay. Representative Reinbold.
Yes.
Yay. Representative Kopp.
No.
Nay. Chair Klayman.
No.
That's two yays, four nays.
So by a vote of two yays and four nays, Amendment Number 7 fails. We do not adopt it. Representative Eastman, may I have a motion to move Amendment Number 8?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I move the adoption of Amendment Number 8.
Object.
We have an objection. Representative Eastman, would you like to speak on what Amendment Number 8 does?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. It is my desire, and I believe the desire of the committee, to ensure that nothing in the statute requires or obligates the principal officer or elder of a recognized church or congregation to solemnize a marriage. And so this amendment simply makes that crystal clear.
Representative Reinbold.
Thank you, Chairman. Basically, I am absolutely passionate about this amendment. I support it wholeheartedly, and I think it's absolutely ridiculous. If we choose to exclude a whole branch of only three branches of government, it's just dead wrong. So I absolutely think this is a critical amendment, and I thank the sponsor for bringing this forth, and I would actually add my name to this sponsor with his permission. This is just an outstanding, critical step to protect anybody who works in the judicial branch of government as well.
Perhaps I'm looking at the Representative Reinbold. I don't believe that Amendment Number 8 speaks to the judicial branch.
My apologies. I skipped it.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
No worries.
I'm sorry.
Question.
Yeah, okay. We have a call to question. Is there anybody going to object?
Wait.
I'm not hearing an objection, so the call to question then goes through. We will have a roll call vote on Amendment Number 8.
Which is D.8. Representative Ledoux?
No.
Nay. Representative Banzler?
No.
Nay. Representative Eastman?
Yay.
Yay. Representative Reinbold?
Yes.
Yay. Representative Kopp?
Nay.
Nay. Chair Klayman?
Nay.
Nay. Two yays, four nays.
So by a roll call vote of two yeas and four nays, we do not adopt Amendment Number 8. That amendment fails. We will move on to Amendment Number 9. Do I have a motion for it?
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. I move the adoption of Amendment Number 9.
Object.
We have an objection. Representative Eastman, can you explain what Amendment Number 9 does?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. This specifies in statute that a marriage commissioner or a judicial officer are not obligated or required to solemnize a marriage.
Representative Reinbold.
I think you guys heard me loud and clear. I don't want to exclude the judicial branch. I think it'd be dead wrong. So I'm a passionate yes on this.
All right. Any further discussion? Is the objection maintained?
Yes, it's maintained.
Mr. Chairman?
Yep, Representative Kopp.
Comment. We read the language of the bill. As Ledge Legal has pointed out to us a couple times, it is permissive. Line 5 says marriages may be solemnized, not marriages shall be solemnized. And the amendment that we have adopted, the first one, we basically, you know, double down on legislative intent. But even with respect to marriage commissioners and judicial officers, I would just point out the language is permissive. And just leave it at that.
Representative Klayman.
Representative Reinbold can speak first.
Representative Reinbold.
I have a question with permission, because everyone keeps referring back to Amendment Number 1. Why did you exclude Number 2 of your amendment, Representative Kopp, 1, 2, 3, and 4? And I believe that was with intent to exclude the judicial branch, Number 2. So I think you're talking out of both sides of your mouth right now.
Point of order, Mr. Chair. I think that the topic of adding 2 Subjection 2 to the bill was a subject of an amendment that we already voted down to First Amendment, so we took that. We've taken this out.
And I'm going to make a point of order here, too. I don't think it's appropriate to say that another representative is speaking out of both sides of their mouth. That's kind of impugning their motives.
As long as we keep it consistent all the time, then I'm fine. I'm fine with that, but we need to not just call it out randomly. It needs to be consistent in with that, but the bottom line, it's very, very confusing when you say they're covered with one and then you exclude them on another. I think it's a very fair statement, but if he could please explain why number 2 was taken out. Now he says they're covered in 9. I don't understand.
So we've got 2 point of orders. I think Representative Ledoux's point of order is well taken. Let's make sure that we Don't accidentally impugn anyone here. We're all, at the end of the day, trying to do what we think is best. So I appreciate everyone's passion. The first point of order by Representative Clayman is that we have already spoken to this amendment, arguably, I believe, with amendment number three.
No, actually, Mr. Chair, it was when we passed amendment number one, there was a motion to amend amendment number one by adding subsection two from A2 into that, and the motion to add subsection two into amendment one failed.
Amendment number, yes. Okay.
So that, because that amendment failed, that topic has been already addressed by the actions of this committee.
It was conceptual amendment number two to add two to this.
Right.
I
think it was your amendment.
That was yours.
I'm asking, are you referring to my amendment? That's what I was asking.
I believe, Representative Clayman, just to be clear, that I think I have it down that that amendment was withdrawn.
It was, because we said that he was going to be
going to speak on it
in this amendment number nine.
And
correct.
At the time, though, Representative Eastman, if I recall correctly, you said that amendment number three spoke to it. And I'm inclined to agree that amendment number three characterizes it because it's now including marriage under Section A. Representative Eastman, I'll let you.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Well, so the question is, has it been spoken to already? And my first thought is, we did determine at the beginning of this, before the First Amendment, that we were going to speak to each amendment separately, which understandably involves some amount of overlap. We could certainly say that by passing Amendment 1, we undid the CS, which we had passed previous, but I'm okay with that. I think we can understand what's taking place here. The question is, well, what have we said? And I would really like to be very clear for the record, you know, what is it that we are trying to say as a committee on this particular issue?
Okay. So it doesn't look like we have more discussion on Amendment Number 9. I'm going to give you a wrap-up, and we're just going to vote on it if that's okay, and we'll go forward from there, even though Representative Clayman's point is well taken. Representative Cobb.
Mr. Chairman, I'll address the kind words of my colleague. So the language in this statute is permissive. It's not prescriptive or directive for any category. Secondly, perfect is always the enemy of good, and why Representative Reinbold and I would both want protections, certainly of conscience, to apply across all eligible persons. It is my perspective that the judiciary already has some flexibility. Additionally, I went to the effort to speak with many members of our judiciary, and not a single one of them wanted this pursued. They do not feel questions of compulsion, and I am confident that if this became a problem, that we would address it, and I would certainly be one to champion it. I think sometimes when we choose the battles in front of us, we can end up damaging the entire goal of what we are trying to accomplish. And right now, I do not see this bill as the vehicle for that issue to be addressed. And this bill does do a lot of good. It extends protections to congregations, our religious leaders, elected officials. I think it does some wonderful things. And I would just conclude with saying that by adding one more thing to it, we could end up undoing it. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Representative Eastman, wrap up.
That is my wrap up, Mr. Chairman.
That is your, okay. Then I will ask for a roll call vote on amendment number 9.
Which is D.9.
D.9, yes.
Representative Fansler.
No.
Nay. Representative Reinbold.
Yes.
Yay. Representative Cox.
Nay.
Nay. Representative Eastman.
Yay.
Yay. Representative Chris Conklin.
Nay.
Nay. Representative Ledoux?
Nay.
Nay. Chair Clayman?
Nay.
Nay. 2 yeas, 5 nays.
So by a vote of 2 yeas, 5 nays, amendment number 9 fails. At this time, we have gone over our allotted amount of time, and I understand that people still have some things to do.
Let's recess this.
So I'm going to recess. Brief it easier. Record. All right. So I am going to hold this bill. We will hear it upcoming under previously heard bills, and I am going to turn the gavel back over to Chair Clayman.
Thank you, Representative Fansler. We are going to adjourn for the day, and our next meeting is going to be Wednesday, March 8th at 1 p.m. We'll hear House Bill 121, Occupation Health and Safety Civil Penalties. I would just note a couple of things with regard to House Bill 20. We had a deadline for amendments last week. I know the hearing has continued, so I would ask that any amendments be submitted to my office by 5 o'clock tomorrow, Tuesday. I'm not sure whether you're going to hear this bill again on Wednesday or Friday, but if you don't have amendments in by 5 o'clock tomorrow, then we won't consider them. And I would just note, Representative Eastman, I know you're new to the body, although Representative Fansler as co-chair or as vice chair is in chairing these meetings, any amendments still go to my office because we manage the whole process. So if you want amendments to be submitted, giving them to Representative Fansler doesn't work. You've got to get them to my office. But we'll enforce that 5 o'clock deadline tomorrow. And with that, we'll stand adjourned today at 3:08 p.m.